This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Hunter Biden's plea deal is on hold after a federal judge raises concerns over the terms of the agreement on two federal misdemeanor tax charges and a felony gun possession charge. CBS News legal contributor Jessica Levinson.
I had thought that behind closed doors, they had come to an agreement, that there was an understanding of what this plea deal included, because the reporting indicated it was so contentious and that it took them so long to come to this agreement.
CBS's Scott McFarland reports.
Republicans have been emphatic and unequivocal over the recent months, saying that this plea agreement was a sweetheart deal, that it not only had that deferred prosecution agreement, which is exceptionally rare in federal criminal cases, but averted prison time.
U.S. District Court Judge Mary Ellen Noreika, who was appointed by President Trump, has raised multiple concerns about the specifics of the deal and has told both sides to work it out and come back next month. At the beginning of a press conference by Senate Republicans, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell froze mid-sentence.
This week has been good bipartisan cooperation and a string of...
More from CBS's Nicole Killian.
McConnell aide said he felt lightheaded and stepped away for a moment, but the incident prompted fresh inquiries about the 81-year-old's health.
Any concerns about his health, or have you noticed anything?
I always wish Leader McConnell well.
It's good to be back.
The Kentucky Republican was out for several weeks earlier this year after falling at a D.C. hotel. He suffered from a fractured rib and a concussion.
The Federal Reserve in its fight against inflation has raised its key interest rate by a quarter of a percentage point. It's the 11th such increase since March of last year, bringing rates from roughly 5.1% to 5.3%. CBS's Carter Evans tells us what that means to grocery shoppers.
We're beginning to see an impact from the historic Fed rate hikes at grocery stores like Tom's Market outside Chicago.
Dairy specifically, prices have come back down to earth a little bit.
Co-owner Nick Costopoulos says the best deals are often on the outer walls of the store, where he recently priced milk below cost.
Well, then that's why it's in the back of the store.
So you have to walk by
everything on the way there.
And pick up a few extra things.
Hopefully.
She was a gifted and troubled Irish performer known for her shaved head and expressive voice. Singer-songwriter Sinead O'Connor has died. O'Connor, who began her music career singing on the streets of Dublin, was a star from her 1987 debut album, The Lion and the Cobra. She became an international sensation in 1990 with her cover of Prince's ballad Nothing Compares to You. Sinead O'Connor was 56. This is CBS News.
Find great hires fast with Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring solution makes it easy to attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
For WCFW and the Tap FM, I'm Jimmy Cuska. Here's what you need to know in the Chippewa Valley. The Eau Claire Area School District is being sued over its handling of open records. It denied a parent in the district and conservative law firm Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty transcripts from an in-class announcement about a teacher that would be undergoing a gender transition. The suit claims the parent was repeatedly rejected in asking for the script that was read to students in the district's orchestra program this summer. The district said it was looking into the incident and that it would reconsider the requests after their investigation. The filing is seeking the scripted statement shared with students, attorney's fees, and damages for the parent and law firm. The Eau Claire City Council approved a $24 wheel tax at last night's meeting, approving it 7-2. The new tax will affect over 52,000 vehicles in Eau Claire that will bring in an estimated $1.29 million to the city for its road repair budget. That's about a quarter of that budget. At Monday's hearing on the topic, public comment was overwhelmingly against the measure. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Cuska.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Tom from Madtown. Welcome, Tom.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, guys. Heard you talking about Robin Boss, so I called Robin Boss's office and said, yeah, why is DEI so dangerous? And nothing. The guy just stopped talking. I said, hello, are you there? I called him back, and the phone got picked up, and then they didn't say anything. You know, maybe you'll learn something if you listen to The Devil's Advocate.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
I have Corrine Hendrickson, part of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Action Needed group.
The Joint Finance Committee, again in the middle of the night, took that out and said, well, hey, you have all this money coming from the federal government. Why don't you use that to create this program? Well, guess what? We proved it worked. Wages went up $2 an hour. There actually are a couple extra childcare businesses open now than there were about a year ago. And that's going to stop. Just Monday, we lost two.
Weekday morning, 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
What if I just, instead of giving out the talk and text line, just started giving up Robin Boss's number all the time?
He needs to hear from us. He needs to know.
It's 844-96-PARTY. What is it?
Write it down. 608-237-9163. Call now.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry and Jane Mattinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ed Council and Pivotal Ventures.
It's what's on tap for the Chippewa Valley. 93.5. The Tap. 93.5. The Tap.
News and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday we were in Washington, D.C., the big event we had with AFA-CWA President Sarah Nelson and Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur. But before the event that we held with those two folks, Sarah Nelson and I and my son Alex were down at the AFL-CIO's headquarters, Black Lives Matter Square Plaza there, with the Writers Guild folks out leafleting, informing people of, you know, the movie that they were going to go in to see. Someone had to write that. Someone's image had to be protected for that. Hey, this is why we're out there. Little informational picket informing folks. Because look, you know, this idea of protecting jobs, this idea of, as we've been talking about, taking on AI and the, well, what is the future of work in this country? Kind of a big thing. But while those are the ones that the Teamsters and the Writers Guild are getting all the attention, there are other folks who are struggling to make inroads as well. And, you know, hotel workers, you know, truck drivers, you name it. And that's why I've asked Mark Kreidler to come talk with us. He's a columnist over at Capital in Maine. You can check out his website, markkreidler.com. Mark, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rick.
So I'm looking at this Writers Guild strike, and I'm going, you know, these folks are just fighting for their existence. But in your piece, and you've got a great article, and I hope folks will take a look at, in this piece, you talk about how the executive, an unknown executive, said, you know what? We don't care. We'll starve them out. We'll go as long as we need to go to these people, lose their apartments, lose their savings, lose everything. And I got to tell you, that to me harkened back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s, and not the 1980s and 90s with the folks like Jay Gould. I can easily pay half the working class to murder the other half. It rang of that for me. I'm curious what you thought.
Yeah, it was interesting because you don't often hear a person in that position say the quiet part out loud, even if they weren't saying it for attribution. The news site Deadline, which is, it reports essentially on Hollywood industry stuff, is the place where that story first broke, and they did quote the executive very specifically as saying, "Look, our plan is to dig in until these writers begin to lose their apartments and lose their homes." Those were the words. You know, there was another executive quoted as saying, "This stuff had been laid in. This plan had been laid in long before the strike actually became a thing." And a third was quoted as saying, "This is a cruel but necessary tactic." So, yeah, I think you can, even though the Alliance of Movie and Television Producers tried to walk that back by saying, "Hey, these unnamed people don't speak for us," their actions make it really clear that that's, it's, if that isn't the intent, Rick, that's exactly where they're headed, because they are not negotiating. There are no negotiations. There are none scheduled. It's been going on for months now. So it's not really that hard to guess that they're trying to starve out the workers, but that's not new news.
Right.
It's just different because we're talking about Hollywood.
No, what's different here in this, and look, as you've said, this is not new. This is every strike that's ever been. It's who can survive the longest. It's a war of attrition, where employers are you know, like, hey, you know, we're going to try and starve you out, and labor's, hey, we're going to last one day longer. The difference here, I think, in this moment is, this is, you know, hearkening back to, as I said, you know, the robber baron era, where you had these monopolies who could hold out, and like the, you know, these big behemoths have the power to withstand these losses, and it's not going to harm them as much as it's going to these workers. And that, I think that has a lot to say about how weak our labor laws are.
Oh, there's no question about that. You know, you're right. There's kind of two things going on at the same time. And one is, this has been coming on for decades, but, you know, decades of deregulated takeovers and mergers means, you know, more and more power is concentrated in fewer and fewer companies. Again, not new news, but it's hit Hollywood to the point where even studios that you would consider major, like Universal Movie Studios, you know, they're owned by Comcast. They were swallowed up by Comcast, you know, some time ago. Disney took over an entire studio in Hollywood, in addition to everything else that Disney already holds. And so, you know, these, what often happens, and the writers are experiencing this, the actors in SAG-AFTRA, the Actors Guild, are also experiencing this, is you think you're negotiating with, let's say, Hollywood, but you're really negotiating with a New York boardroom or the boardroom of a multinational corporation, wherever it might be headquartered, in which your concern is but a tiny sliver of their corporate concern. There's a really great article, by the way. Jennifer Rubin wrote this in the Washington Post. Jennifer has been a columnist at the Post for a long time. But prior to that, Rick, she was a labor and employment lawyer for a bunch of different Hollywood studios. She's very familiar with the industry in LA. And basically she said, look, in the same sense that some banks were deemed too big to fail, some of these corporations may now be on the brink of being too big to strike. Their pockets are just way too deep. They've got the resources. And, you know, if you're Hollywood, if you're the writers, for example, there's 11,000 writers in the Writers Guild, you just don't take up but a tiny, tiny bit of their bandwidth in terms of what their corporation's trying to do. And where does labor law come in? Well, nowhere. Because the labor laws as currently written are, A, 50 years out of date, and B, so weak that they make no difference.
And the fact that, you know, the reality is what these studios want to do is just replace those people as a whole and have computers do their work. And this, again, is, you know, we were just talking a little bit ago about, you know, the tech that's coming and what it's going to do, you know, with us, we, the working people. I look at this strike going on with the Writers Guild and the screen and SAG-AFTRA as the front line of the AI war. This is the first battle in what's going to be the future of work in this country. And we working people had better come around to the idea that we should be on the side of the working people.
Agreed. I think that that's something that the writers and particularly actors have had to try to find ways to combat, because the public perception is, you know, you're a rich Hollywood actor. What do I care what, you know, about your labor situation? For the writers in particular, you know, part of what brought them to the brink of a strike and then to a strike is the fact that over the last several years, a number of the studios have said, we're going to use fewer writers. Now we're going to use fewer, now fewer, now fewer. And eventually the idea is that, you know, AI could replicate or amalgamate the work that writers have done for decades, well, from, you know, a century and beyond, and essentially replace the writers outright. Now, with actors, their concern over AI is a little bit more shaded, but it's not hard to understand.
Right.
They stand against the studios being able to film their image and then replicate that image in, you know, a million other uses. And so in both cases, I think we tend to get distracted by the fact that occasionally one of the people speaking about this issue is someone I've seen on TV. or that I've seen in a movie. And it lends sort of this weird air of unreality to the whole thing. But they're fighting a ground level battle. It is absolutely, to your point, it's a ground level fight for their continued value as workers, period. And it's really important to keep in mind, and this is true, of course, in Hollywood right now, but it's true, you know, in so many places in our country, that you're dealing again with multinational corporation that doesn't care at all about that, because they're not really in the entertainment business. They're in the stock profit business. And you're just one small part of their overall push to raise that stock price.
No, it's all about the dollars and cents. You listen to The Rick Smith Show with Mark Kreidler. Mark's a columnist over at Capital & Man. You can check out his website, markkreidler.com. Most certainly you need to check out his most recent article, How Striking Hollywood Creators and Hotel Housekeepers Face the Same Kind of Obstacles. And those obstacles are a behemoth corporation who have extraordinarily deep pockets. Now, in your article, you do talk about the Writers Guild and the Screen Actors and how they're handling their situation. Now, housekeepers, they've got other problems, because they can't all withhold their labor, because you know what? They'll all be replaced tomorrow, if I'm getting this right.
Yeah, it's a really interesting twist. So the actors and the writers both just straight up struck. They walked off. Productions have been halted. You know, there's very little Hollywood production even occurring right now, unless it's a straight reality series. And even in that case, a lot of people will not work on those shows. But that's a calculated gamble, especially with the actors. You know, they're sort of in a stronger position, because I think they can reasonably say, go ahead, try and make a movie or a TV show without us. The hotel workers are not in that position. They are far more easily replaced. But they do, just like the Writers Guild and SAG-AFTRA, the Actors Guild, they do face corporate behemoths. You might be standing in a picket in front of one hotel near, you know, Los Angeles International Airport. But the truth is, you're trying to battle Hilton or Hyatt or Marriott or one of the private equity firms that is also a multinational that holds several of these properties at once. It's not hard. I've done it. Anyone who wants to and interested enough can do it. You can look on job sites in LA and see that these hotels are already, you know, trying to pre-stack their deck with workers who are ready to come in and take the shifts of anyone who strikes. So instead of going off, you know, en masse, thousands and 15,000 hotel workers all going out at once, they've done these targeted strikes, Rick, where they will hit six or seven hotels for a day or 2 days. They started with a three-day strike in the downtown hotels in LA. Every one of those has the benefit of generating headlines, but also the hotels, who are at this point sort of loosely bargaining as a group, about 45 of them are bargaining as an alliance. They don't know what's coming. They don't know who's getting struck and when. And it's far more effective, but it's also, as the Guild in LA has shared with me, it's kind of their only move. They can't go off the job. They can't just walk off. They'll be replaced. And again, this is where, in a different time, labor law would step in and say, you can't do that.
Right.
But in this time and place, it can be done.
Not only labor law was different, but we were different. And I'm hoping, you know, this is one of those things where I come back to, I'm hoping that we somehow wake up and take back some of the ideas of the old mentality and shut things down. We're across, you know, across industries. And I know secondary boycotts are secondary strikes are illegal and all that stuff. But you know what? In the 1930s, they didn't care about laws. They shut things down.
Yeah. It's been interesting to see in Los Angeles, especially, there are a number of unions that are cooperating in ways that they've never done before. There are, you know, the hotel workers are hardly the only service employees who are struggling right now. There are workers in theme parks and Disney and other studio lots who are similarly in tough spots. And they're also negotiating contracts. And for the first time in really anyone's memory in LA, you know, these unions are now sharing their negotiation information. They're sharing the offers they're receiving with other unions. They want each other to know what it is they're being offered, and so that they can't be played off one another.
Right.
That's something I think that's been missing from union organized labor activity for a long, long time. And I think if you look at the sort of roadmap of labor in the United States, you'll see this really disparate collection of mostly smaller groups. There are a few really powerful larger unions. Everybody else is 50,000 or less. And, you know, it makes more sense to pool that power. And that's been a long time coming. So it's really interesting to see how some of the unions in LA have tried to attack this by, at the very least, pooling their information. And by the way, you know, the Writers Guild has been on the picket line alongside the hotel workers and vice versa. SAG-AFTRA members have showed up at the hotel worker strikes and vice versa. So it's a summer of labor unrest in LA, and it may ultimately turn out to really be a summer of solidarity. The question is, what does that lead to? Yeah. And we just don't know the answer.
No, as I always say, look, you know, we're in a moment right now where, you know, the hope is that we start adopting a striker and we find our way to a picket line. And we get out there, and because, you know, as the old saying goes, the larger the picket, the shorter the strike. So the more people who are involved, the more people who are taking part of it, maybe there will be some influence. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, we're in this moment where you've got these behemoth corporations who have such overweighted power. You know, mm-hmm. You know, what do people do? How do we push back in a better way, do you think? Are you seeing what they're doing is successful, or is this something legislatively that we've got to eventually come around to, or is this a people thing?
Well, the larger answer, I think, is certainly, you know, takes you to Washington, D.C., and, you know, the will of congressional leaders to enact stronger labor laws, and for that matter, enforce the ones that are already on the books. Short of that, one thing that's interesting about what Hollywood's doing, and the hotel workers have done this pretty effectively too, is, you know, sort of understanding that part of the process, you know, the rules violations part of the process has really got no teeth right now. They're just publicly shaming these companies. They're going right after the CEOs, for example, of the Hollywood studios, repeatedly pointing out their unbelievable compensation packages, repeatedly pointing out what the studios make. The hotel workers in LA have done a really effective job in this same way. Hollywood has the added advantage of being able to say, here's the CEO of Disney, Bob Iger. Here's exactly what he got paid last year. You can publicly embarrass and shame these companies, and some of them, who do to a certain extent rely on people's goodwill for their business, will take note. Whether it affects their behavior at the bargaining table, we don't know yet. But it's one of the only ways, the only tactics that I think has a realistic chance. It's not perfect, and it takes a hell of a lot of effort, and it takes some community support. But it can work.
And it takes communication. You got to get out, and you got to talk to other working people. This is not, we can no longer be in a moment of isolated strikes and isolated instances. We've got to bring everyone in. It's got to be a community thing. As I said, you know, like my grandparents' generation, they understood secondary boycotts and secondary strikes. When the company down the street went on strike, everybody on the street went on strike. That's how we have to return. But Mark, I appreciate the work. I appreciate the time. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again as this continues. The piece, How Striking Hollywood Creators and Hotel Housekeepers Face the Same Obstacles, written by Mark Kreidler. We'll get a link out on social media. You can check out his website, markkreidler.com. Mark, thanks so much, buddy. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks, Rick.
Want to hear your thoughts? 1-866-416-RICK. 1-866-416-7425. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Now, look, here's the reality. You've got these workers who are on strike, and they're taking on enormous power, and they know it. Look, they know that these studios are out to break them. And this is not unique to them. This is every strike that happens. There's the calculus of how long can the company last, how long can the workforce last, and that's when they start talking again. What happened with the Teamsters and UPS? UPS figured out, hey, they're serious. We could lose billions of dollars if this is a prolonged strike. And the White House stayed out of it. Good on them. Understanding, look, if you're going to be the most pro-union president in our lifetime, you got to go, get out there and fight for yours. Get out there and fight for better wages, hours, conditions. Get out there and do the work. And I think that is that's a testament to the administration. Now, how Wall Street wanted to frame it is wanting to scare everybody. Go, well, it's going to hurt the economy. Well, maybe it will. That's part of this. But it would be UPS would have been the one causing that. Because, look, the Teamster said all along, we're willing to negotiate. We're willing to sit down and talk about anything. But at the end of the day, you're an extraordinarily profitable company. You make your profit off the backs of our workers, our members, and their labor. They're getting some of it. And this is, kind of the same fight that's going on with the Writers Guild. Going, look, you keep cutting us, but you're making enormous profits. These streaming services are wildly profitable, making huge money. Their CEOs are pocketing enormous sums. We're just trying to eke out an existence. Now, look, I was in D.C. yesterday with probably, I think there were like 70 70 folks from the Writers Guild and the SAG-AFTRA folks. Nobody I recognized. Nobody I saw on TV. Nobody go, hey, I know you. None of them. These are people who they go to work and they do their job and they make enough to exist because they're doing what they're passionate about, what they love to do, and they're eking out an existence. The one person told me, they made like $38,000 a year. And I'm going, how? Well, this is what they've done to us. And when you find out that the vast majority of people who are on strike don't make all that much money, and there's only a handful of people who are making the millions, there's only one Tom Cruise. There are only a handful of people who are in that pay. Everybody else is just trying to make a living. And that's what should come out of this writer's strike and out of this Screen Actors Guild strike, because they are fighting for the extras who make $100 a day. They're fighting for the people who are trying to break into the business. Now, understand, this could be bad for the industry down the road. Not having anyone willing to come and be an extra because, hey, once I sell you my likeness once, you get to use it forever. And I'm working for you literally forever for free. Hello? That's why I say this is the first battle in this war. Now, there are going to be a lot of lawsuits going down the road as AI comes out. And the question is Mitt Romney right? Are corporations people? Is AI going to be a person? Will Siri be a person? Will Siri be able to vote at some point? Because evidently we're going to replace working people with computers. Now, what I find interesting, there's a lawsuit out there, and I think Sarah Silverman and a couple other people are involved in this, who are saying, hey, how can these computers have original thoughts? How can they write these scripts? How can they write articles? How can they do things without stealing from the internet and someone else's intellectual property? And it's an interesting argument, one that I think actually holds some weight. Question is, the Supreme Court, who seems to be the NASCAR of the Chamber of Commerce, funded by all of the big special interests, which way do they go? Which side are they on in this? Me, I'm on the side of the workers in every scenario, because working people have been getting screwed for so long.
This is another one of those moments where every person should be saying, yeah, this is a fight we should all be involved in. This is something that we should all be supporting. Getting out in the streets and marching with these folks. Because, again, this is one of those weird moments where first they come for the extras. He said nothing. Then they came for the writers. Said nothing. Then they came for the actors. Said nothing. And eventually all of us are going to be replaced by a computer. Then what? Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You excited about the brave new world? Want to hear your thoughts. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1990. That was the day that George H.W. Bush signed into law the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA prohibits employment discrimination of people with disabilities and requires public accommodations to be accessible. The passage of the act was the result of years of grassroots organizing by members of the ADA community and their allies. When President Bush signed the law, he said that if he had to thank everyone who had been involved, we'd never get out of here before sunset. The passage of the act had bipartisan support, but many business leaders worried about the ADA's effect, fearing the costs of accessibility accommodations to their bottom lines. While most business leaders did not oppose the act outright, they did push for amendments and concessions to weaken its impact. The business newspaper, The Wall Street Journal, called the act, quote, the Lawyers Employment Act, warning that a flood of lawsuits on disability issues would harm businesses. In signing the bill, President Bush addressed business leaders specifically. He said, quote, you've called for new sources of workers. Well, many of our fellow citizens with disabilities are unemployed. They want to work, and they can work. And this is a tremendous pool of people. And remember, this is a tremendous pool of people who will bring to jobs diversity, loyalty, proven low turnover rate, and only one request, the chance to prove themselves. The passage of the ADA paved the way for fundamental changes in America's infrastructure, such as accessibility ramps, spots for wheelchairs on buses and subways, and parking accommodations. This was a major step forward, yet more work remains in order to build a society truly accessible to all. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
As John Mellencamp sings, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. True. And it's equally true that if you stand for everything, you won't amount to anything. In a remarkable achievement, a newly formed political party calling itself No Labels has managed to fall into both traps, standing up for everything and nothing at all. The fledgling entity is using every synonym in the book to assure everyone that it is a middle-of-the-road bipartisan centrist, both sides party, offering hybrid liberal-conservative solutions that won't offend anyone. But wait, they've chosen a multimillionaire coal baron and a multimillionaire son of a global plastics polluter to be their standard bearers. As a presidential ticket, Democrat Joe Manchin and Republican John Huntsman probably would unite voters of both parties. Against them. While they don't stand for much, there is one huge overriding issue that the No Labels hucksters strongly agree on. Corporate money contaminating American politics. These, quote, reformers are in favor of it. Indeed, secret fat cat donations are the No Labelers' financial lifeline, having already hauled in hundreds of thousands of dollars from right-wing corporate interests. Such as... No, no, say the founders, we can't tell you who's buying the No Labels label, for the funders don't want the public to know their names or their special interests. Of course, secret funding of elections equals secret government of, by and far, the funders. By standing against the people's right to know, the group has put a flaming neon fraud label on their hokey reform party. Huntsman even admits it, saying financial disclosure would be the right thing to do, but, quote, that's not the way you play the game. This is Jim Hightower saying, the game? Just what we need. Another gang of corporate politicos who think governing America is a game to be won by hook or crook.
to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some good news. Consumer confidence up everywhere. Everybody's, yeah, things are going well. Stock market's doing well, they say. Inflation's down, wages up, people are buying stuff, things are good, except Biden's, approval rating and the fact that, you know, it's his policies that have made a lot of this possible. It's interesting how it plays out. Interesting. But, you know, in survey after survey, you know, consumer confidence is up. That's a good thing. Maybe it's going to equate into, well, some going, hey, it's those policies that we've been talking about here on the show for, I don't know, 18 years, you know, like reshoring manufacturing, you know, rebuilding our infrastructure, you know, that kind of stuff. Seems like a good idea. Also, it would be great if we had a tax code. If we had a tax code that encouraged work and rewarded work and well, you know, not so much of moving money from one pocket to the other. That's why good news today, a number of folks put forth the Oligarch Act, oppose limitless inequality, growth, and reverse community harms act. That's a mouthful, but it's the Oligarch Act. And it's like, hey, we're going to start taxing some of these people. And here to share some thoughts on the Oligarch Act, I've asked Bob Lord to come talk with us. Bob is a senior advisor on tax policy with the good folks over at the Patriotic Millionaires. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, good to be on.
So walk me through, what is the Oligarch Act and what's it going to do?
The Oligarch Act, I think, Rick, is the first tax bill of its kind. It is directed not so much at raising revenue, although it will raise revenue, but at addressing inequality. And what the Oligarch Act does is it takes the median household wealth, the family in America that's richer than half the population and poorer than the other half, you know, the typical family right in the middle. And it says, if you've got more than 1,000 times that much wealth, which would be over $120 million, you're going to pay 2% tax annually on the amount of wealth over that. And then it says, if you've got over 10,000 times that much wealth, well, then that the amount above 10,000 times is going to be 4%, and 100,000 times wealth, anything over that, 6%. And if you've got 1,000,000 times the wealth of that typical family, then you're going to pay 8% on the amount above 1,000,000 times. And believe it or not, we do have 3 Americans with more than 1,000,000 times the wealth of the typical household.
1,000,000 times. Because I was going to ask, how much is 1,000,000 times the typical? What number is that?
It would be more than $121 billion.
And they would pay 8% tax on that $121 billion.
On the amount they have above the $121
above.
Billion.
So we're giving them, no, don't worry about that $120 billion. We'll only take that dollar, 8% of that dollar above. I don't know.
Oh yeah, but Rick, the amount in between $12 billion and $120 billion, they'll pay 6% on that. So, you know, if this bill's enacted within a decade, we will have a much more equal America. We will restore the distribution of wealth that worked for us so well in the 1950s and 60s.
So you're saying to me, I want to get this right, because I just said that I'd like to dig up Eisenhower and bring back the good socialist president's tax code. You're saying we're getting back there?
Yeah, it'll be a different kind of tax code. We'll be taking the dollars from them in a different way, but because it'll be a wealth tax instead of an income tax, but we'll be getting to about the same result.
So now I can already hear my frustrated millionaires now losing their minds. What, you're raising taxes? You know, when I become a $120 billionaire, I'm not going to want to pay this tax.
Rick, not the ones I work with. I'm with the Patriotic Millionaires.
Oh, I'm talking about the ones who aren't actually millionaires, the ones who think they're going to win that lottery. The people who told me that we're taxed enough already, that you know, there's too many taxes. We need to tighten the belt and learn to live within our means. Those folks.
We all said that already. We have all these people out here who never, ever will be subject to the estate tax, but they are against the estate tax because they think they're going to be super, super rich one day, and they don't want to have to pay it.
And I've said before, look, I would love to be able to pay the 8% tax that you guys are proposing. I'd love to pay that. That means I'd have $120 billion.
Right.
I mean, I don't know where the objectionable part of this is, because, you know, as my friend Morris Pearl likes to point out, the chairman of your organization, the Patriotic Millionaires, he wants to be able to walk down the street. He doesn't want to have to hire armed guards, and he wants to be able to live, you know, kind of in a country that's free and open to everyone and not have to worry about, you know, I don't know, grandkids getting snatched up in the middle of the night. And I don't disagree with him.
Exactly. Morris says that, you know, he's just as greedy as other millionaires. He's just greedy for a different kind of America, the one where everybody's happy.
So what are the chances of this piece of legislation, which was introduced by a number of House Democrats? I don't see a Republican's name anywhere near this. And I gotta be honest, I find it interesting because I don't see this being objectionable. You have people who have such enormous wealth, you know, and we've got so many needs and a deficit that's so big and debt that's so big that, you know, it seems like, I don't know, the person with all the money should be the one kicking in a little bit.
Well, you know, when we conceived of this proposal about a year ago, and, you know, we started speaking to members of the House members, and, you know, started with Kevin McCarthy and, you know, went through all the Republicans first. No, we didn't, of course. We didn't go that route. But no, they're not going to be on board. And it's going to take a year, a year and a half or so to kind of socialize this, to get folks used to the idea. And by then, hopefully, we'll have a different Congress come 2025, which, you know, won't have quite as many Republicans, and we can get this thing passed.
Yeah. Now, look, I was seeing some of the numbers that you guys were throwing around. Something like, you know, we've got, I thought we had more than 735 billionaires. I thought we were over 1,000. But you guys say that 735 billionaires saw their collective wealth grow during the pandemic over $4.7 trillion. You know, while the average working family saw their standard of living actually go down. I don't know. I know I've heard people say, you know, all the rich people pay all the taxes. I mean, it seems like they got all the money. I mean, this just seems like something that should really be nonpartisan, that working people should go, look, we need better roads and bridges and schools and healthcare and infrastructure. We need all this stuff. It's got to be paid for. Our work creates this wealth for these folks. Maybe we should be distributing it a little differently. That seems logical to me.
Oh, absolutely. And no, they don't pay all the taxes. I mean, you know, Gabriel Zucman and Emmanuel Saez, you know, showed this, how the top 400 taxpayers pay total tax at a lower rate than everybody else.
Yeah, that's what giving people all the money and buying lobbyists and politicians will get you. While, as you guys point out, 60% of this country is living paycheck to paycheck.
And it doesn't trickle down, and no, they're not job creators. You know what creates jobs? Consumer demand creates jobs. Money in people's pockets is what creates jobs.
You know, so I look at the fact, you know, again, you threw out this statistic that we've used a number of times on this show, that, you know, that 40% of the country can't afford a $400 financial emergency, which is just incredible to me, and that a third of the people who get up every day and go to work make less than $15 an hour. And you go, we've got people who have such unimaginable wealth. The fact that we wouldn't go, hey,
maybe kick in a little bit. Now, here's the thing, that the question I have for you, because I've said for a number of years that if we had a much higher tax rate, maybe we wouldn't have so many people making less than $15 an hour. Maybe we would have a more equal distribution of wealth, because these wealthy people wouldn't want to pay it to the government. They might pay it out in better wages and funding health care and funding schools and funding other stuff. Might want to spend it a little bit differently locally. That's the argument that
I mean, like the way it worked in the 50s and 60s?
Yeah, kind of like that.
Right.
No, but I think that's important pointing out.
In inflation adjusted dollars, the highest our minimum wage ever was in 1968, and it's effectively decreased since then.
Yeah, it was $1.60 an hour back then.
Well, whatever it was, it's equivalent to, I think, $15 an hour now or something like that. I don't know what the actual number was, but when you adjust for inflation, it's a lot more than the $7.25 an hour minimum wage we have today.
Yeah, no, it was $1.60 an hour back then, and you're right, it was double the current minimum wage, thanks to the fact that we haven't seen an increase. Now, in fact, this month, 14 years ago this month was the last time we increased the minimum wage, and that was the Bush administration. So we went through the entire 8 years of Obama, the four of Trump, and now the entire Biden term with no increase in the minimum wage. In fact, today you had Bernie Sanders and Bobby Scott put forth the Raise the Wage Act, looking for a $17 an hour minimum wage, which doesn't stand a snowball's chance in passing, because we've got a Republican Party who's hell-bent on doing nothing in the House but talking about UFOs. I guess maybe we'll see a UFO before we see a minimum wage increase.
You don't increase the minimum wage for 14 years. That's, when you take into account inflation, that's about a 40 to 50% pay reduction.
So how do we get this, Bob? How do we get this? You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Bob Lord. He's a senior tax advisor with the Patriotic Millionaires. How do we get this moved forward? I talk to individuals all the time. And when you have individual conversations, this is common sense. We have these gazillionaires who've made so much money off the backs of working people, who are not paying the kind of tax rates that past generations have used, and they're hoarding huge amounts of resources that could be used more effectively. How do we get that into the groupthink? Because individually, I've yet to find someone who says, no, it's a good thing to have Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. It's a good thing to have gazillionaires who have more power than governments. How do we get it into that groupthink idea?
Well, the public's attitude has changed, and changed in a good way. Folks overwhelmingly do want to tax these billionaires. It has to change faster, and it has to change more overwhelmingly. And look, this is a start. For things to happen, they have to start somewhere.
Right.
And I think, proposals like this, and this isn't the only one out there. President Biden's billionaire minimum income tax is a huge step in the right direction too. And it's a matter of, the proposals being made and people demanding it. Power concedes nothing without a demand. And we need a country that collectively demands the change. And something, Rick, it's got to happen in 2024, because we're running out of time.
No, this to me is a huge election year issue, because we've given so much power and control to a handful of people that they control our politics. And there's a Republican Party right now who's not doing anything to help average everyday working people, because the pain and the suffering and the misery benefits them. Those Democrats, they're not doing their job. But Republicans are the ones gumming up the system. No ideas there whatsoever. So for me, the idea of going back to a tax code that rewards work, but says, no, we're not going to have gazillionaires. No, it's not good. It's not healthy for democracy to have this kind of wealth that isn't being productively used. I just think that's a winning message in 24.
You know something, Rick? It's not even good for the billionaires. That kind of wealth doesn't help people. It makes them unhappy.
I don't know. I think I would be happy if I had $1 billion. I don't know if I would be any happier with 120 than one, but
And this is where I guess the, that
what,
question
what
becomes.
Are you going to do with $1 billion that you couldn't do with 50 million?
See, now here's where I'm probably different. I would want a legacy. I would take on an issue like, you know, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and I was just talking about this. As a kid, you know, at the end of the month, there was no food in our house. And it wasn't just our house, it was the whole neighborhood. So childhood hunger to me is an important issue. I would be the one who said, you know, I got $1 billion. I'm going to do what I can to ensure that that doesn't happen. And this is the thing that bothers me with a lot of our billionaires. I'm not seeing the kind of, well, benevolence that people believe that they have. I'm not seeing the kind of, you know, and you think of Andrew Carnegie, he built a library system. We have very few. And look, he was, a no good for nothing SOB from what a bunch of people have told me. But, you know, his legacy was the library system. Why don't we have billionaires who think in those terms?
They don't. And in fact, they as a percentage of their wealth, they give less than everybody else.
Of course, that's how they got to be billionaires.
These billionaires, I think they average $10 million a year in charitable giving. Now, wow. $10 million is a lot of money, but not when you're worth, you know, multiple billions of dollars. It's a really tiny percentage.
Yeah. So last question I've got for you. How do we get involved? What's the marching order for me? What do I do when I wake up? What's the motivator?
Anything that we can do to make the demand, you know, whether it's, you know, phone calls to representatives and senators, organizing people to rally for this, to vote, putting the question to these politicians at town halls, whatever we can do to make our voices heard, we got to do.
There you go. PatrioticMillionaires.org, the website, if you want to take a look at the work that they're doing. Bob Lord, senior tax advisor there with the Patriotic Millionaires. Bob, always great talking with you, man. Good stuff, as always.
Thanks, Rick. Good to be here.
All right, let's take a quick break. I want to hear your thoughts. Should we be taxing billionaires? Do you agree with Jesse Ventura, former governor of Minnesota, or should that never be a billionaire? I'm in the Jesse camp. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1775. That was the day the United States Post Office was created in Philadelphia under Benjamin Franklin. Franklin was a member of the Second Continental Congress. Among many other distinctions, Ben Franklin was named the nation's first Postmaster General. Franklin received a salary of $1,000, with an additional $340 for a secretary and comptroller. His responsibilities spanned all post offices from Massachusetts to Georgia, and he had the authority to hire additional postmasters as necessary. Previously, in 1753, Benjamin Franklin helped lead the postal service in the colonies. He made numerous improvements in the mail system, including setting up new, more efficient routes. He had also been able to cut delivery time in half between Philadelphia and New York by having weekly mail wagons travel both day and night via relay teams. In 1774, the British fired Franklin from his postmaster job because of his revolutionary activities. There have been postal unions dating back to the 19th century. Those early unions had essentially no bargaining rights. They existed largely as lobbying organizations that otherwise would have no say about their working conditions. Wage increases depended on the whim of Congress. On March 18, 1970, thousands of New York City postal workers walked off the job in protest. They were joined in the streets by 200,000 others in 30 major cities. Mail service ground to a halt, and the plight of postal workers was brought to the public's attention. The strike was soon settled, with Congress approving a 6% wage increase. The strike served as an impetus for the enactment of the Postal Reorganization Act of 1970, which granted unions the right to negotiate with management over their wages, benefits, and working conditions. Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Now, look, you know, going back to this tax thing, you know, the reality is, and some of the numbers that that Bob's organization put out, when you look at the fact that, you know, like they said, 60% of the people in this country are living hand to mouth, paycheck to paycheck. The money comes in, money goes out. It never makes it to the next week. 40% of people can't come up with $400. And interestingly enough, I have a friend who's a homeless advocate. And she says, look, you know, one of the main reasons for homelessness, and it's mind-blowing when you stop and think about it. One of the main reasons people are homeless, car repairs. I mean, stop, let that sink in for a second. Your car breaks down. You got to come up with $400 or $500 to get the car fixed. You don't have it. You don't have a credit card, you know, the elasticity of a credit card, or maybe you're maxed out, whatever. You can't get the car fixed. So then what happens? Well, you can't get to work because public transportation in this country sucks. So now you lose your job. Now you lose your job. You got no money. Now you end up losing the place where you live. And because you've gotten thrown out of one place, doesn't that means you're probably not getting another, because you don't have any money. So just something simple like, you know, the alternator went, could lead to mass chaos. And that has everything to do with the fact that a lot of the jobs in this country, sorry, just don't pay. So when I see, you know, these right-wing think tanks saying, oh my gosh, they're talking about raising the minimum wage, that's going to cost 130,000 jobs. Is it? And where are you getting, which orifice did you pull that number out of? I think I have an idea. Because what we know, when you raise the minimum wage, there's actually an increase, very slight, but an increase in jobs. And why is that? Well, that's because more people have money in their pocket to spend locally. And that is the engine, as Bob Lord pointed out, that's the engine for an economy. People with disposable income spending money on, you know, stuff that they need, like a new alternator. The fact that you have, as I said, a third of the people in this country working for less than $15 an hour, that's a problem with distribution of wealth. Now, understand, as we talked about, the minimum wage back in the late 60s was $1.60 an hour, or in today's terms, twice what our minimum wage is, which meant that everybody across the board was at least making. Now, again, the minimum wage does leave out a lot of people, and we can get into that argument if we have to. But for the mass of people, especially the folks making minimum wage, it was something you could almost live on. Something you could, have an apartment, drive a crummy car, pay your college tuition on, and you know, go to school. No people have done it. And what happens is, when we have this kind of mass inequality like we're suffering through right now, social mobility goes down. You have, you know, other outcomes of poor social outcomes. You have lower life expectancy. You've got all kinds of more mental illness, all kinds of negatives. And as Bob said, you know, the reality is rich people aren't any happier. Are you happier with $120 billion than you were with $119 billion? Well, maybe we should ask Elon Musk, who evidently, Mr. Free Speech, decided that he was going to ban an ad launched by the folks over at the Progress Action Fund. Evidently, this, it's called Keep Republicans Out of Your Bedroom. This was the name of the ad. And evidently, it's been banned on X. It's no longer Twitter. It's now X. And this is one of those moments where you go, yeah, I know Elon killed Twitter, $44 billion. It's done. It's now X, which, you know, we can ridicule all we want. But the fact of the matter is, he took what was a social media platform that a lot of left and center left groups, you know, had some clout in, and completely wiped it away, and has turned it into, you know, basically Gab or Parler or a right-wing cesspool.
congratulations. He did exactly what he wanted to do, because what, $44 billion, you know, of lost money doesn't mean anything to him. This, not good for democracy. And look, you know, what X is doing is silencing people that he doesn't agree with. Now, this is a guy who told you he believes in free speech. This is a guy who said, I bought Twitter because free speech. Silencing free speech. Now, look, I you know, if you want to have that argument, it's about free speech. I know there are some purists. Great, fine, do that. But don't be the hypocrite of it, which is what Musk is. Because at the end of the day, he's a dictator. And I would argue not a benevolent one. Ask his workers. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. You'll get...